Hello and welcome to Davey Forum's podcast for Monday the 22nd of July.
Will that be nice?
Wish.
It would be nice. It's January, folks. It's the first podcast back since Christmas. And joining me on this edition, Assistant Editor Steve Withers.
Bring me the boar worms.
News Editor Mark Hodgkinson.
Onward, my brave hawksman.
And Audio Reviewer Ed Selly.
Clytus, I'm bored. What plaything can you offer me today?
So, welcome back to the podcast, whatever, after Christmas. We're not well, people. We've just managed to clump ourselves together for this podcast. It's been one hell of a CES, Steve.
Yeah, it has, I think. I don't remember much of it, to be honest. It's all like a fever dream. But yeah, I think just anything that could have gone wrong went wrong on CES. From illness to water pouring out of the roof ceiling, from the roof onto my bed in the middle of the night, which had me rushing around trying to find pots and pans. It all started so well, and we had such grand plans.
I blame the Selly. It was going fine until he turned up.
Jonah.
Bite me. If I turned up ill and infected you, that would be legitimate. But let's be completely clear about this. I didn't turn up ill, and I didn't get ill. So, you know, you can accuse me of being bad, you know, like a 6-foot-tall black cat. But you were obviously gestating whatever ailed you. And despite your best efforts, I didn't catch it. So, you know, sorry.
Tell you what I feel sorry for. Whoever moved into that apartment after us was like moving into a plague pit.
I just noticed that someone's commented on the post-mortem video. Ed Selly doing it right. I'm certain that's how he kept healthy. His stare in places looked like he could do with a cowboy hat and some chewing tobacco. I completely agree. And if we end up going back to the desert, I will ensure that I have some more accoutrements with me for next year. And maybe a slightly longer t-shirt. We'll see how we go.
I want to laugh, but I'll just cough if I do.
Yeah, more props. That's what we need.
So Mark, how are you for health-wise?
Health-wise, I'm doing a lot better than you two are. By the sounds of it. Yeah, I've been all right. Yeah, no complaints here. Just getting back into the swing of real life this week. So, yeah, feeling quite good.
All right, so the kids are finally back to school, are they?
Yeah, exactly that. The kids are back in school this week. So it's been, nice peace and quiet and getting down to some work.
Yeah, I got back and I've just caught up with TV. I don't know about you, Steve and Ed, but there's plenty of quality TV to catch up on. I'm loving the new Wheeler Dealers. I'm sorry, I was sad to see Ed go, but I have to say, they've really upped the game in terms of what it is that they're working on. And the last episode I watched Ed, it was a Mach 1 Mustang, and that's the holy grail in my book.
So that presumably entailed an entire box of tissues. Does this mean that Anstead has started to redeem himself in your eyes, or is that still
too far? No, I haven't disliked the guy in the stuff that he's been in the past. The one he did with
Philip Glenister.
Glenister, yeah. It's a different format to the one that and I can see why Ed walked, because it's less about, you know, the ins and outs of fixing something and more a case of I'm going to fix this and it gets fixed rather than completely explaining what's going on. So you lose that bit a little bit. But in terms of an entertainment show, they're picking the right cars at the minute to keep me interested. The last three cars have been really good. And like I say, the Mach 1 Mustang, that's one of my holy grail cars. One of those. Because I'll never be able to afford a 60s. They're just way out of price range. £100,000 for a decent one these days.
Well, it depends. I mean, if you want a fastback and stuff, yeah. You can get a notchback for less than that.
Well, a coupe and stuff. But I'm not interested in the coupe. I want a fastback. I want a 68 fastback. And you know, you're talking 60 to 100 grand for a decent one. So when you start looking at the Mach 1s, they start making a little bit more sense in terms of you might be able to own one eventually. And I've got to say, I quite like the Mach 1 body angle. So I've been watching that, been catching up with the Orville as well. Have you been catching up with that, Steve?
I did. I caught up with the two episodes we missed while we were away, which were both excellent. It's just full-on Star Trek, isn't it?
It is brilliant. I mean, he's tackling some really tough subjects, like gender issues was the last one I watched, and the one before that was... this is how well I'm keeping things in my memory at the minute. I've completely forgotten what it was.
Female Command before that.
That's right, yes. So, you know, he's tackled some really big issues in there. He still can't act and walks around with the same expression on his face, but everybody else is really, really good. The characters are good and the stories are excellent. And you got to think that
and
there
some
is...
quite big names keep popping up, too.
Yeah, Liam Neeson and Charlize Theron.
Charlize Theron are very large names. Yeah. Obviously, they were in... I guess they were in How A Million Ways to Die in the West, so he's obviously bringing in friends from the films he's made. But, I'm loving it. I think it's funny, but it's also... a lovely homage to Star Trek, and it's more Star Trek, although I must admit, I'm thoroughly enjoying Star Trek Discovery, which is back on again as well, if you haven't, don't know that. Two episodes of that to catch up on. That's the classic Star Trek now, sort of mirror universes, can't beat that. Very different, enjoying it because it's different mainly. But yeah, if you want pure classic Trek, The Orville is it.
Yeah, it's excellent. I still got to catch up with Discovery. I've kind of got six episodes of the first half and the new
That's
two.
That's most of the first half.
Then. Yeah, most of it. But then I haven't had that much time. The other TV that I caught up with, Ed will appreciate, was also The Grand Tour, which for season two, they've really upped the game. They've got rid of the dross. And it's a lot tighter this year, Ed.
It's all right. I still can't get that excited about it. And I have to admit to being, with regards to last Friday's episode, I was a little bit disappointed at the just brutality they meted out to what is actually a fairly rare car, which I thought was a bit of a shame. But it's watchable. I have sort of caught up on a little bit of telly, but I've mainly been listening to the sort of 4 kilos of records I dragged back with me. So that's where I've been focusing most of my energy.
Okay, so that's reference one. See how many more references we get this week.
I was going to say, I haven't got round to Wheeler Dealers yet. I haven't got anywhere near that. I think I've still got Street Outlaws to do as well, because, you know, for my sins. And there's a couple of other things I haven't got around to. I did kick off with that Britannia thing on Sky last night.
Is that any good?
Oh, yeah.
It's mental. it has the potential to be good mental, but it could just as easily turn out to be very bad mental. And an hour and 15 wasn't quite enough.
I'll let you do the hard yards on that one. Yeah. You can do the heavy lifting and let us know if there's any
good like this. My wife is already out. I kind of like that period in history. Not that there's a huge amount of historical accuracy going on here. I'll give it another episode, see where we go.
Speaking of mental, also back on Netflix is Dirk Gently's Solicitor Detective Agency, which is proper mad. So if you like a bit of that, I can recommend.
I like the
that.
Books. But,
well, the TV series is it's based on the books, obviously, but it's written by Max Landis, who's done some interesting stuff. He wrote Bright, actually, which was on over Christmas on Netflix, and
which was really, really good. I wasn't expecting much from it, and really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was weird, wasn't it? Because it was like watching a big tentpole Hollywood movie, but getting to watch it in the home cinema on day of release instead. I quite like that concept.
Yeah, it wasn't brilliant in any, but it was good for the money that they've obviously thrown at it. The fact that Will Smith was in it, and it was a nice sort of twist on things. I don't look too closely, because I'm sure there's massive plot holes in there. But I didn't, which kind of says quite a bit about it. If you're not going looking for the issues with it, and you're just sitting there letting it wash over you, then obviously it's doing its job.
It was fun. I enjoyed it, and apparently it did very well too in terms of. Apparently, they said that if they'd equated the viewing numbers for it in the States into box office terms, it would have been like 190 to 100 million opening weekend. So it was a success.
Right, but they didn't make 190 to 100 million.
Well, no, million, I mean, if that many people who watched it on Netflix had gone to the cinema instead to see it, that's what the equivalent would have been.
So if I was a shareholder in Netflix, I'd be saying, well, why did we not do a theatrical release?
Well, I guess that's the whole point of there. Business model, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, kind of. Right, let's move on. Current competitions, Mark?
No.
What do you mean? You're not going to do it, or there's no competitions?
No, I mean, there aren't any.
All right, okay. I thought you were standing up to authority there, Mark.
Rebellion has started.
No, we're not doing it.
Right, so previous competition winners, then. Do we have any?
Yes, most definitely. We've got Eddie Boy, who I'm guessing is a Celtic fan. He won the Limehouse Golem, and that's a Blu-ray book and signed poster. And then we've got Miller LFC, probably a Liverpool supporter, who won Dunkirk on 4K Blu-ray. And then we have M. Komen, who won Atomic Blonde on Blu-ray.
Is he an MK Dons fan?
It could be. And then there's EB 1470, who's an Ebbsfleet Town fan. And Rainbow Witch 666.
And who does he support?
Well, I'd have no idea. No, I can't even venture one on that. And they both won a Kit Sound Voice One wireless speaker.
Well, there you go. Some big prizes being won there. Congratulations. Wow. So I guess we need to move on and do our post-mortem of CES. We've already done the video, which Ed's alluded to. The video is live on YouTube and on the forums. It's the three of us standing out in the desert. What you didn't see was the amount of tissues that were used, because we're standing in the desert. We look kind of healthy, I think.
Don't overread.
well, let's just say there was colour in the face, and I didn't need to add that in when I graded the footage. So we had some colour about us, but we stood in the desert. We forgot a couple of things. Is always the case when you're unscripted, as we are, standing in the middle of the desert, trying to remember what it is that you've seen and trying to remember what's real and what wasn't real through your fever. But anyway, the video's there. Go and have a look at the video. We're going to get into it a little bit more detail. So let's start at the start, Steve. The first thing that we went to officially for CES was Samsung's preview night.
Yes, that was on the Sunday night. They had their first look event where they didn't show any models whatsoever. It was all just technology that they were showing, some of it coming this year, some of it not. As a bit of sort of flag waving and like, look at us, it worked quite well. They hadn't had a great 2017, something they admitted to themselves. And I think the idea behind this was really to show that they have some interesting tech both coming this year and that they're working on for future years, possibly game-changing tech in the sense of micro-LED. We all knew that was what they were working on. The big question really is, and one that's still unanswered, it has to be said even after CES, is when this technology is actually going to come to market for consumers in a realistic price point and a realistic screen size. We don't know. They didn't know either. If you ask them the question, the answer will be anywhere between 1 and 9 years, which is pretty vague, let's be honest about it. So they don't know, but it is coming. But in the meantime, obviously, they need to have something for this year. And so what they're really sort of concentrating on is pushing LCD technology as far as they possibly can. So 8K panel, more zones. I mean, they're talking about thousands of zones.
10,000.
Yeah, well, they initially said 40,000 and then went back to 10,000, and now it's if you read different
128.
Yeah, it's vague. Again, like I said, they were pretty vague on a lot of the details here. Even though we did a sort of behind the scenes demo, you know, that they still were fairly vague on a lot of the detail. Yeah, they said 10,000, although I've seen other people reporting that other Samsung representatives have said less than that. They initially said more than that. I don't know. But it's a lot, I guess, is the answer. Certainly looking at the demos, the level of haloing was non-existent. They really were controlling it very well. So I think there are a lot of controllable zones. How exactly they're doing it is another question entirely, but certainly it does work. And one thing they worked very hard on was trying to eliminate off-axis issues as much as possible. And again, they have done a really good job on that. Compared to other LCD TVs, the off-axis performance is really, really good. They seem to be spending a lot of time and money trying to turn an LCD television as close as possible into an OLED TV, rather than just getting an OLED panel.
But they've been doing this for decades, because, you know, we were saying exactly the same thing back in the days of plasma. They were talking about all these zones, and we were saying, well, you're just describing a plasma TV there with millions. I mean, the end game is 8 million dimmable pixels, isn't it?
Yes, so that's what they want.
That's the end game. Just develop an OLED TV, it does it already.
Do you think they would have released an 8K TV this year if they hadn't had such a poor year last year at the top of the market?
I think the hand's definitely been pushed. We definitely got that feeling. Everybody was upbeat. Everybody was talking up the technology. Everybody was talking up Samsung. It was absolutely packed out. We were told that we weren't going to get two tickets to it. Then we were told we would get two tickets to it. I think the same story was told to a lot of people just to generate the hype, basically, to get the reporters along, to get everybody along to tell their story, because they needed a story. They are the only major manufacturer of the big companies who do not have an OLED TV. So they needed to show something that was a little bit different to LCD TVs, because that's all they manufacture at the minute. This micro LED looks great, but is it vaporware? This is the big question. You know, if we were in Samsung's position, we would be scrambling to show something as well.
What is the point of the wall? Why not just make micro LED TVs in a variety of sizes rather than having a modular design? What is the point in that?
I think it's because they can do it. And yeah. it's a story, and it's something to tell. The other thing that myself and Steve were talking about is if you have that technology, you could do a 21:9 TV. Yeah. You could have a CinemaScope TV, and depending on the processing behind it, and I would imagine it would be an off-board processor of some description if you're talking about a modular design. Already you're talking about clever processing in there to match all the displays to each other. So it's going to have some processing power behind it. So why not do 21:9 screens and that kind of thing on the back of that processing? There's lots of what ifs, and this is the problem though. It's all what ifs at the minute, Steve, isn't it? And it's a case of, is it vaporware or are we actually going to see it?
I think ultimately it's not vaporware. I don't think they're showing something we're never going to see again. I think that is definitely there.
Sony with CLED?
Well, no, Sony did do that, but I don't think that's not Samsung's game here. I think that they absolutely want to release a micro LED TV to consumers. It's just a question of when. It's not a question of whether they will or won't they. They will do it. It's a question of when and how quickly they can do it, because I think they'd like to do it next year. Well, but that's dependent on so many other factors.
Yeah, so what if it's cost prohibitive?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the reason they were showing that, I'm pretty sure the reason that they had that modular the wall TV up there was just because they were just porting across their tech from the cinemas, weren't they? Mm-hmm. And that 146-inch screen was a 4K screen in total, which means that the modules weren't 4K. You know, they were composed of larger pixels than would normally be the case on something that small. So there's a lot of jiggery-pokery going on, let's be honest about it. It was a marketing exercise as much as anything. Yep. But I do believe that their ultimate goal is micro LED. I don't think this is something they're just showing for the sake of it. I think that their end game is, they told us that their end game is absolutely to deliver it as a consumer product. But what they can't say for sure at the moment is how long that's going to take them to do.
Yeah, because they're not going to get into bed with LG, are they? They're not going to go buy all their pants. So their hands are kind of tied. Really,
yeah.
They have to come up with something else, which is why they bought QLED a couple of years ago, because they want that end game, they want that end technology. It's just a shame that when they did that, they then called the next range of Quantum Dot TVs QLEDs, because it kind of diminished the technology that was actually meant. Yeah. So let's hope they don't do that again, because I think they would lose a lot of credibility if they did that again.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think they need to be really careful here, because they've got a bit of rep here now for pushing things as something that's new, which technically isn't. I mean, even LED LCD TV, which even we call LED TVs now just for the sake of, you know, ease, it's just an LCD panel with an LED backlight. So there's been a lot of this going on. Micro LED is definitely absolutely new tech. This is game-changing tech. If they can get it to work at a realistic price point, we're talking about brighter, you know, much, much brighter images, absolute blacks, wide color gamuts. I mean, it's got everything it needs to deliver HDR within the terms of the HDR spec, which can go up as high as, you know, as Rec 2020 and 10,000 nits. So there is massive potential there. But that doesn't mean write off OLED in the meantime, because OLED still is the best picture performance you're going to get for the next few years at anything approaching a realistic price. So don't write off OLED yet. But what you will see, obviously, Samsung do this year is push the big numbers, because that's the area where they can. Show an advantage over OLED. So they were talking about 4,000 nits of peak brightness on this new TV. We'll see whether that's the case when it comes to market. You know, wider than 100% of DCI-P3. Whether you actually need that is, of course, debatable, because the movies themselves are graded at DCI-P3. So you don't actually need more than that at the moment. But they'll be able to deliver wider than that if they want to. So yeah, we'll see them shouting those big numbers. But you know, don't anyone who's just bought an OLED or thinking of buying an OLED is, you know, that is still the best tech on the market right now, overall. When you weigh it all up, I still think that delivers the best picture.
Yeah, well, I echo everything you've said. Really. That was the impression I got from waiting back here, that Sam's going to just playing the numbers game, playing for the future, you know, showcasing what they've got. But it's nothing really tangible for the 2018, and you know, they're treading water a little bit while they've got actual new product to release.
It is a difficult position for them, Ed, isn't it? It's like they haven't got anything new to show, but they have to show something.
Yes. And it befouls manufacturers in various categories at various shows, and has done since we've had trade shows. But yeah, there is a sort of heroic level of standing on principle here by Samsung. And this is only going to come off if they get their alternative into scope and into people's consciousness before they sort of cease to be a premier television manufacturer. I mean, don't get me wrong. I you know, to be very clear on this, I, you know, when Samsung say they had a bad year, that's fair. But actually, if you look at it in a wider sense, they bounced back from the Note 7 exploding phone debacle reasonably well, and their phone division is doing good work, and so on and so forth. They it's important not to overstate that in many of the categories they compete, they've got good ideas, good products, and they've got a good pricing structure. It's only with this specific area of televisions that they've got some fun and games going on. And yeah, I everything that needs to be said has basically been said. They either make it work and make it work relatively quickly, or I can't see them ever going for something that requires them to play nice with LG. So it's either that, or they just sort of wind things down.
It was one of the sort of talking of LG. What was the percentage of the high end market that LG had in the UK? It was one of the interviews. I can't remember which. It was 40-something%, wasn't it?
40-something yeah. percent. They took. They basically became the dominant premier TV provider last year in the UK. So they knocked Samsung off the top spot. I mean, Samsung's still utterly dominating the mid-range tellies.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
In terms of premier TV, so higher-end televisions, LG are now the dominant player.
Where the margin is, isn't it? That's where the margin is.
Yeah.
Where the margin. I mean, that's the idea of premiumization. That when did you go and visit LG, Phil?
Oh, that was 2013.
Yeah, so they've turned that idea around in less than 5 years, haven't
yeah.
they?
Premiumization, that was the word.
Premiumization. And with this... 3D look calibration with Kalman now, in that's going to cement more at the high end, I would think, anyway.
Well, that's been a benefit of them working with Panasonic, really. Yes. That's they'll deny that, but you can see that the DNA is there, that they've been working closely with Panasonic on that one to improve that side of things. So, you know, it's their baby. They want to try and push it. They want to try and make sure that OLED is the dominant TV for the next, I would say, at least 3 or 4 years, if not longer. And with prices now down to, I think it was about £1,400 for a B7 over Christmas. Yeah. That's just astonishing value for what you're actually getting there. And of course, once you start hitting those price points, you start getting Joe Public buying into it. The word of mouth then starts again. They start talking to amongst their friends. So you go from people like AV Forums members who families go and ask about TVs and stuff. Once you get down to the actual end consumer talking about your technology and talking about it, that's where the power is. That's where you then start getting into more and more mainstream homes. And once people know that, then it becomes more and more popular. Prices come down and you've got a bit of a domination of the market for a little while. And that's what that is LG's end game. That's what they're looking for. And they're doing a really good job of it at the minute. You've got to ask if it's still a loss leader. Because they did run it for a few years as a loss leader, absolutely.
I can't believe they're making a huge amount on B7s and the like, but I suspect across the multiple sets that they do, that there's a bit more padding on some of the more spendy options.
Well, when it's the same TV, Ed, and all you're doing is changing the design as you go up the range, then your margins get bigger as you go up the range.
So... It obviously it comes down to just how many of us cheapskates buy B7s and run away, but I think in as much as any television model offers the scope to make money, because it's not where you really want to go for that, it looks pretty solid, and there's some clever add-ons as well. I mean, their soundbar stuff that's not built into televisions but is available as aftermarket options are pretty solid, and obviously this time with Meridian isn't going to do them any harm, so it looks pretty logical. I mean, the thing I sort of found myself wondering idly the other day after I'd come back is, in light of what we were saying about the fact that we are close to, if you like, the ultimate evolution of OLED as a technology, it's quite a short lifespan in an absolute sense, is LG now working on the next big thing somewhere deep in a laboratory in South Korea? I was about to say North Korea, but no, South Korea. I mean, where do they go from here? I mean, they have to have one eye on the long term. They're a multinational. They always do. So I'm just wondering what they're planning next.
I don't think anybody knows that one, Ed.
Well, no.
And if they do know, then they're sworn to secrecy at the minute.
While they're cleaning up on OLED, there's no point in them telling us what they've got up in there.
No, no, they're not going to suddenly say, here's our next big thing while they're still pushing the new big thing. But if we know that the future is brighter displays and wider colour gamuts, then they obviously must know that too. So I'm sure that they are... I mean, they're aware of the limitations of OLED, which is that it's never going to be more than 1,000 nits of peak brightness. So they realise that ultimately... That a point will come where that's considered not bright enough.
Yeah, because I mean, let's remember that OLED was developed in a time of SDR. You know, HDR kind of dropped on the market as the technology was maturing. So it was never designed from the outset to be any brighter than it is at the minute. And they've tried to coax as much as they can out of the technology without then, you know, raising the black levels and spoiling the image quality that OLED's known for. And the other thing is overdriving the panels, you know, because it's self-admissive, because of the way it works, there is a risk of burning, there is a risk of image retention. If people run their sets too bright, run the panels too hard, you know, they're going to have those issues. And they're going to have the issues if they're trying to get more and more brightness out of it as well. So it's got its limitations, there's no doubt about that. But then it was a technology that was designed way before the HDR craze came along.
True, but I think what people tend to forget, particularly when manufacturers like Samsung are pushing numbers of brightness, particularly brightness. You know, we're talking about TVs coming out this year that are going to be hitting 2,500 to 4,000 nits of peak brightness. Obviously, we saw a demo of a Sony prototype that was hitting 10,000 nits of peak brightness. But it's worth remembering that the dynamic range is the difference between black and white, you know, between absolute black and peak white. And with an OLED, where you're talking about absolute black and then also highlights that are delivered at a pixel level, the dynamic range that is apparent to you can be quite spectacular, even though you know that it isn't hitting maybe a full 1,000 nits or even above that, 4,000 nits. I mean, Mark, you just moved over to OLED and started to embrace HDR on OLED. What are your thoughts?
It's a world away from the LED LCD that it replaced. It's mega. I mean, I absolutely love it. And it's hard to envisage anything a lot better, really, in terms of, you know, watching late at night and kicking back and watching a movie in the near dark. It's just an extremely nice experience. Yeah, I mean, I love OLED now, and the motion processing is fantastic on the TV I've got, I'm very, very happy. I'm set probably for the next 5-6 years. I can't see myself wanting to upgrade for any particular reason.
What did you buy?
Philips.
All right.
902. Yes.
Well, I was surprised that I was expecting a B7 there.
No,
I got it. No, he likes Ambilight.
I do like Ambilight, and the motion processing was... I was wary about LG's motion handling, to be quite honest. And I watched a lot of sport, and the Philips getting such rave reviews for its motion handling, that was the selling factor. Plus, it got a good price on it.
And you can connect up to your Hue lights as well.
Yeah, I've got like eight Hue lights around the home now.
I think a lot of big criticism was levelled at LG, not by us, but by some of the readership, membership, that their range this year was very similar to last year, which it is, but I'm not quite sure what they expected LG to do. I mean, the fact is that last year's range was bloody good.
You know, successful. They already
very successful, very good. It delivered great picture quality at very competitive prices. It has every HDR format you can think of apart from HDR 10 plus already. So I'm not quite sure what they were supposed to do that was going to be massively different.
The problem is for LG is, you know, they've got such a similar range that why would you buy the new range if you can still get a P7 for around about 1,500 to 1,700 quid? Why would you buy into the, you know, what is the new range offering that the old range? And apart from the dumbing down the B.
Well, I think if you're looking for a new TV this year, then I would definitely still be looking at C8 as a sweet spot. You're right, there's not gigantic differences, but I do think the Alpha 9 processor, the new Kalman auto-calibration features, the addition of black frame insertion, and also the decontouring feature that they're adding. These are all things that people have been asking for. They've also tweaked the motion handling, going back to Mark's point a few minutes ago. So I do think that they've addressed issues that have been raised about the previous generation, added things that people have asked for. And I do think that it is just an evolution of last year's models. I do think they're certainly worthy of consideration. But you're right. If you're thinking of buying a B8, then you might as well just buy a B7 because that's basically the same TV.
But the improvements in ABL, haven't they? That's something that I do notice about an OLED, is that suddenly if there's a bright screen particularly with this Philips, I think, is that it drops down quite quickly and quite significantly in brightness. Just for, you know, quite it doesn't bother me especially, but I think it would be nice to see that improved.
They've tweaked it. I don't think they've made a massive difference to it.
Right. I thought they changed the pixel structure slightly, so the green pixels are a different shape and it holds brightness a bit better across the mid-range.
Yeah, that's what they've done. We'll see how
I say, it was never. It's not a major deal as far as I'm concerned, but I can understand, you know, that's an improvement. Maybe not something worthy of shelling out an extra £1,000 on, but, you know, eventually the B7s won't be available, will they?
Yeah, they'll gradually phase them out.
So you'll be buying a C8 then, Steve?
Oh, I wouldn't mind a C8. I think it's a lovely looking telly. Yeah, I could probably, I'll definitely, if I do upgrade at some point, I've come to the conclusion pretty quickly that I should have got a 65-inch instead of a 55-inch. The screen size is always important. Size does matter, doesn't it, when it comes to this kind of thing?
Size always matters, Steve. Well, does it matter what they say?
But no, I'm impressed with the new LG range, even though it's not a gigantic leap on from last year. I still think that they're delivering of all the manufacturers, they're obviously the ones delivering a wide range of different models. Granted, most of them are just cosmetically different, but yeah, I think they're still delivering the overall the best bang for your buck, no question about that.
I'm glad you did that.
And given something we'll be talking about a bit later on, not directly related to CES, at least their TVs do work with their HDMI and Dolby Vision.
Yeah. Right, so wrapping up on LG, we also got a behind-the-scenes, closed-door look at LG Display. So LG Display is different from LG Electronics. So these are the guys that develop the next TVs. They're the guys who are developing the panels. It's who LG and everybody else buy their panels from. A couple of interesting TVs in there. A lot of it was commercial business-to-business stuff that they were showing off, but there were a couple of interesting things that could make it to the consumer market. First one being an 8K TV. Obviously, it won't turn up until the HDMI 2.1 is available. But again, it was a 88-inch OLED panel, so they are now cutting larger pieces of glass to make their OLEDs bigger. 77 was always the biggest that they could do, so 88, that's quite a bit of difference there. 8K, so they're managing to ram all the pixels in there as well, and it looked pretty good, Steve.
Did look very good, yeah. I mean, obviously, that is, we're talking about where they're going next. I mean, they've already announced this, but we can expect to see 8K OLED TVs next year, definitely, being available, being shown to CES, then available later in the year. And there's no question that's the next thing. And I know people are saying, why are manufacturers getting on the 8K bandwagon? Because there's no 8K content. But obviously, you know, they want something to sell. And you know, even if you don't have 8K content, having how many millions of pixels to play with, when you're doing the processing, even if you're upscaling, you know, always having this extra level of number of pixels for processing capabilities is always an advantage. So yes, we had 4K TVs before there was any 4K content. We'll have 8K TVs before there's any 8K content. But
somebody needs to support the Japanese Olympics. So
yeah, yeah. So that's absolutely one thing we're going to be seeing. The other thing that we saw, one other thing we did see. This was what they call it, Crystal Sound, weren't they? Which is basically their version of Sony's Acoustic Surface. So I think we're going to see a lot more OLED TVs with acoustic surfaces, which I got to say was one of the things from last year that I thought was absolutely revolutionary for me. I thought the idea of using the screen itself as a speaker is quite inspired, and worked really well, sounded great, and I think we're going to see a lot more of that being used. Perhaps not from this year from LG, certainly, but I think the year after. Something we'll be seeing.
And the other thing that we saw, which was really quite interesting, it's something that we've been predicting for a while because it's one of the benefits of OLED technology, and that's the flexibility of it. It was the roll-up TV, the roll-up, roll-down TV. We predicted that this was going to appear at some point during the OLED's life. And we've seen it in previous years where they've rolled up bits of material and that kind of thing, but the problem was it always killed a few pixels every time you rolled the material. So by the time it came to about the 25th demonstration of the technology, a lot of the pixels were dead by that point. But this one, they were rolling up, they weren't doing it very often, they were doing it once per session for the journalists and everybody else that was getting taken around. But it looked like it wasn't doing any damage to the screen, and it looked like it was viable tech, Steve.
Yeah, no, it looked bloody impressive, I have to say, particularly since it was actually on as it rolled out and in. That's something that you're thinking, well, if they can deliver that on a nice big, really big screen, so like an 88-inch, then that's a genuinely viable alternative to using a projector, isn't it? Having a roll-up screen.
Yeah, one thing it was always pitched to me, even back in the early days of OLED and LG and others, was the fact that one day you'll be able to have a 10-foot or a 12-foot screen in your living room and it'll just come down from the ceiling and then roll away again when you don't need it. And that's always been the holy grail for home cinema fans, is having something like that. And this, I guess, is the first sort of viable step towards that kind of future. Although it was the other way around, it was rolling up and rolling down rather than...
Yeah, I didn't like that box. The look of that box, it looked bloody ugly. Well, they did on the videos, but as a tech, it's amazing. What I did like was being able to sort of adjust the aspect ratio up and down as you needed it. For that, that looked really attractive. Should be good, that.
No, if they can bring that to market and it doesn't break every time it rolls, then yeah, fantastic. But that's the problem, though, in the past, is it's always broken once I've rolled it a few times.
Yeah, it didn't seem to be broken when we saw it, but like you say, Phil, they weren't doing it up and down constantly, were they? They were doing it once or twice. I think they did it twice in our demo.
Yeah.
So that was it. But interesting tech, and certainly a glimpse of what OLED could deliver in the future. And I think from... for projector fans, a real possibility of an alternative to using a projector, and also meaning that you can get the benefits of HDR, which you just can't from a projector, from a roll-up screen. So, I'm excited about it.
Well, I mean, we're getting to the point now, Steve, where getting screens through UK spec doors is going to be an issue. You're talking about bigger and bigger screen sizes, 75 inches and above. You're then getting to the point where how do you get them into the house? Because they're now bigger than the doorways that they have to get through. So do you have to start taking walls out or windows out to get these big screens in? Because this has always been the holy grail. Or have a 100-inch screen at home, but how the hell do you get 100 inches through a doorway? You're going to have to bend it at some point.
It'd be slightly easier if you can roll it up, wouldn't it? than if it's just a massive screen. But it's interesting how many people ask us. One of the questions we get asked a lot relating to OLED is, why can't LG Display makes smaller screen sizes? Because the smallest they make is 55 inches, which I know I was bemoaning the fact it was too small a minute ago, but for most people in most homes, 55 inches is still considered a very large screen.
It's getting the pixel density, isn't it? That's the problem.
Problem. Because they'd like
that's the same with micro LED, isn't it? That's the problem with that.
Yeah, I think that's always going to be big screen sizes. But people would like to see. I mean, and I'm sure that they LG would like to do it if they could, because there's clearly a demand for it. But unfortunately, I think at the moment 55 is as small as it's going to go. So, like I said, 55 is not
big enough anyway. It is a shame. It is a shame that they can't do it. But you've got to think there's a lot of money to be spent to try and get that kind of pixel density down to, say, even a 49-inch TV. That's got to be a huge challenge. And it's probably not cost-effective for them to do that. They'll sell lots of them, but it wouldn't cover the R&D, I don't think, to get to
what was
stage.
The resolution of that? Was it a 15-inch or 12-inch OLED that
reviewed
many years ago?
That was a 720.
720,
yeah.
Wasn't it?
It was classed as HD, but it was 720 resolution on it.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's LG. So who have we yet to cover? Sony. Let's go to Sony. So not a big range from Sony. They only launched one new screen, really, Steve, when it comes to OLED. The same as the A1 in terms of specification.
Yeah, I wouldn't even call it a new screen, really.
Yeah. Well, basically, it's a stand-up screen. It sits on a proper, what we'd call a proper stand, and it sits up at 90 degrees rather than lean back. Yeah. And I think that was the biggest advantage of the new screen. And the rear's been redesigned, and it's actually quite a nice redesign on the rear as well, so you can it's easier to wall mount and so on. So yes, it looks nicer because it sits up nice and square on. And I think all three of us like that aspect.
I actually preferred the AF8 to the A1, totally. I think it was a much nice, more attractive design. It'd be interesting to see what happens here, because technically the A1 is still the flagship and the AF8 is the new TV, so it's below it. But Mark's just been talking about, if they've changed the pixel structure, then is the AF8 using a new panel compared to the A1, which has got a better APL? What's the pricing going to be? It seems to me that you just get the AF8. Why would you buy the A1 at all? I can't see any logic behind it, unless you absolutely love the look of it. Just get the AF8. Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out, because their range this year is strange. First of all, the flagship LCD TV is still the ZD9. Now, I can't remember the last time a single model spanned three different years. Can you? That's quite unusual. Then you've got the X9, XF90, which is going to be the new sort of below the ZD9, and I guess the new flagship for this year in terms of new TVs. No XF93, no XF94, and then they got the XF85 and 80. I've got to say the XF90 did look really impressive in the demo that I saw behind the scenes, and some of the new tech like Motion Clarity X looks really interesting, using the backlight to brighten parts of the picture so that the black frame resolution doesn't cause the whole thing to dim. Actually looked really impressive, giving it like deep blacks but nice bright peak highlights as well. So I like the look of that. So that'd be interesting, particularly if it's price competitive. That could be quite a strong contender, I think.
Just to clear it up, X Motion Clarity, that's just the XS90, is it? Or is it on the F8 as well?
No, just the on the X.
Just on the A, yeah, makes more sense.
XS90. Yeah.
Good.
I wouldn't use black frame insertion. Well, you could use it for an SDR content, but when it comes to HDR on an OLED, it just doesn't work because it dims it too much, and you need every ounce, you know, every pixel of brightness you can squeeze out of the telly on an HDR. So,
and it doesn't flicker.
Well, it wasn't flickering for me, but it's a very personal thing. But the thing is that Sony use 48 hertz, so that's why they are prone to more flicker than say Panasonic and LG that do it at 60 hertz. So I wasn't seeing any flicker myself, but it depends on the content too. Football can often be the one where you really see a shed load of flicker on a Sony telly, so it's going to vary from person to person. I know I am
usable in its previous guise on Sony TVs because it flickered for me badly.
Obviously, we'll know a lot more about the UK lineup. They're having their launch event in 3 weeks' time, isn't it? 7th of February?
Yeah, 7th of February.
So we'll have a lot more detail in terms of what the actual models are for the UK and what technologies are going to make it into the UK market and so on by then. So we should have a better idea of things.
Yes, and possibly some comment on other things too.
Well, let's jump that onto that one then, because it is relevant at the minute. So Sony, you know, they're one of many companies who in the past 18 months have said, yes, buy our TVs and we'll update the firmware to Dolby Vision. What they haven't specified in any great terms is what kind of Dolby Vision you're getting. And it seems to be that they've rolled out the Dolby Vision update in the US so far. I'm not aware of it having happened anywhere else at this moment in time. And it only appears to be Dolby Vision for the apps in the TV and not on the HDMI ports.
Yeah, well, it's kind of hearsay, as you say. We don't know. We haven't had a UK set to test, and the firmware hasn't been released here yet. So we're just going off word of mouth from US owners. But it appears that the Sony TVs have got their own special Dolby Vision profile, which is referred to, at least we think, by Oppo as low latency Dolby Vision, which means that the bulk of the processing is done at source, the HDMI source, rather than on the TV, which is the case with other Dolby Vision TVs. So it requires the HDMI sources to be updated to support this new low latency profile. I honestly don't think it's that big a deal, because we're talking about two Blu-ray players and the Apple TV 4K at the minute as Dolby Vision external sources. The Oppo have already apparently said they're going to update their devices to support it, and you'd assume Apple will do the same down the line. I can understand that people are upset because Sony were far from transparent about how they would implement this update, and it's been waiting an awful long time as is. So yeah, I can understand the frustrations, but in my opinion, it's not that big a deal if the current available Dolby Vision HDMI sources are updated. And you would assume and you can be certain that Sony's DV player will definitely support this profile, and you'd assume that any future players with Dolby Vision on board will also support this profile if Dolby get involved. What I think it does bring into question is this idea of Dolby having so much control over the software, and are there resources enough to service all the Dolby Vision sources going forward if they have to be involved in software updates on both sides for the TV and the source equipment?
Kind of the last thing they really want at the minute, Steve, considering the momentum that's now gaining behind HDR10+.
It's not ideal. This is something that I was told, this is when we were at the show actually, I was talking to another manufacturer, I'm not going to say who they were, but I was asking them about Dolby Vision, because this manufacturer supports Dolby Vision in the States and in Asia, but they weren't going to be supporting it in the UK and Europe. They're going to be using HDR10+. I said, well, why don't you just do Dolby Vision? He said, well, because our chipset that we use in Europe is different from the one that we use in the States and in Asia, and it doesn't support Dolby Vision directly. He said, we could add a backdoor chipset to bolt on Dolby Vision, but Dolby wouldn't let us. He said, strangely, he said, that's exactly what Sony are doing. And so, and I didn't at the time, I mean, this was the first I'd heard about this at the time. This is before this broke. But now it starts to make sense. So what happened is, like we said at CES 2017, it was a very last-minute decision on the part of Sony to add or add Dolby Vision in the future. Their chipset wasn't fully capable of doing it, and they've had to add a second chipset on the back door to actually do it, which is why there's a whole different profile for Sony TVs. And obviously, Dolby were prepared to let them do that because they wanted a big name like Sony on board, along with LG, to give them momentum. And I think it's not ideal for Dolby Vision, but obviously they wanted the big name on board. I think for a manufacturer to promise something in January 2017 and still be unable to deliver it correctly in January 2018 doesn't look good. I think if you're expecting other manufacturers to basically bail you out by updating their equipment to work with yours, I mean, Oppo will do it because it's one of their big selling points, but I can't see other manufacturers really good. You know, if Panasonic aren't going to be any rush to fix their new player to work with a Sony TV, are they? I mean, it seems like a strange approach to take.
Well, there was a lot of issues with the LG player as well, wasn't it? I mean, it's still,
yeah, that's still
not quite right.
Technically doesn't do it.
Yeah.
It does do it, sorry. If you did the update they launched in August and kept that update, which is what I did, it still works fine with Dolby Vision, but there have been... they did actually withdraw that update later. It's been a... obviously, Dolby Vision's rollout hasn't been as perfect as Dolby would like. And there have been teething problems. There's been issues with black levels on LG TVs as well, over HDMI, which they've just announced a fix for. So, yes, there's been issues. It hasn't been smooth. But I think at the end of the day, that's not as important as just having a big, long list of names on your side. And that's why Sony got a pass from Dolby, the way that maybe other smaller manufacturers haven't been getting.
Well, that's
because they wanted that big name.
That's you making that assumption, Steve. That's your
opinion. Well, that's my opinion, and obviously the opinion of another manufacturer. I think from Dolby's perspective, what's important is having people in their camp. And if it doesn't quite go smoothly, then so be it. But at least they can say, you know, at their press events or when we were there with them last week, you know, oh, we've got Sony and we've got LG, and talking about in the US or Asia, they've got Hisense and TCL and Philips and Vizio and Lerva and Vestel now as well, and Toshiba, etc. So they if you can list a long list of names, it looks good, and that's, I think, the important thing currently.
I think it also calls into question that what chipset Sony are going to use this year in their TVs. You didn't really get any information on that. Tend to find out when they're released, don't we?
Yeah, well, they were also talking about, this is what they said to us about Dolby Vision particularly. They said, obviously, that we'd already been announced that they're rolling out the update for the 2017 TVs. That's going to start next month. And then they said that there will be an update for the 2018 TVs later. So they're not launching with Dolby Vision built
in. I find that more staggering than anything.
Very strange. Yeah, I was like, what? So, yes, that's not going to be there on launch. It'll be added later via a firmware update. Which I've got to say, right now, if I was thinking of buying a TV, I would not be getting a Sony. If Dolby Vision is something you think is going to be important to you, just get an LG. They already do it. They've been doing it for 3 years. Yeah, I can't say this fills me with any confidence. So you're going to deliver it at any kind of decent timescale either.
You've got AVRs have got to start supporting this Dolby Vision profile as well, haven't you? That another intermediary equipment. Are they going to support low latency? Will that happen?
Yes,
but that's the thing.
That's a whole load of more software that needs doing and Dolby's involvement with.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. If you're putting the onus upon the other manufacturers to bail you out, then unless it's in that manufacturer's interest, which I think it would be in the case of, say, Oppo, where they could say, look at our all singing, all dancing player. But other manufacturers are going to say, you know what, Sony sod you. We're not going to bail you out just because you couldn't deliver it properly. So I can see this being a real issue for Sony owners.
You would think that Dolby would step in at that moment in time, though, Steve. I don't think they would let other manufacturers do that and not support it. I think it would be part of the licensing agreement that they have to support other manufacturers' Dolby Vision kit. I don't think you'll get you'd ever come to the scenario that you're suggesting there. I don't think that would ever happen.
It would sort of go against the whole ethos of Dolby being this closed and controlled ecosystem, wouldn't it?
I think it's something Panasonic said a year or two ago that they were slightly worried of how much control Dolby have over their yep. over their TVs, and yep. and this is exactly this kind of example I would think they were referring to, that yep. where they're waiting for Dolby to sort out this software issue.
Yeah, I think another thing is that people need to be fully aware that if they buy a product and the manufacturer says we'll update it later, don't take that as being the case. Don't ever take that as being the case. You buy a product on what it's able to do when you buy it. Do not take the risk of buying a product because somebody along the line has said, well, we'll update it, because this is what happens a lot of the time. Yeah. And then you're left with, well, why did I buy this product? Why did I pay the money for this product? Because I assuming that it was going to get updated. I would always buy a product that has the stuff that I want on it when I buy it, not 6 months down the line, or yeah. in the case of Sony, almost a year later from when they promised it.
More than a year now. But I also checked the small print. I noticed they did cover some of this in some very small print on the promotional materials, which they certainly weren't making clear initially. It's been disingenuous from Sony, if nothing else. It's been a bit, I'd say, slightly misleading in their approach to this whole Dolby Vision thing. But like you say, Phil, yeah. But if you want something, make sure it's got it when you buy it.
Yeah,
just on the safe side.
Absolutely. So other TVs and stuff, we cover it in the video. So go and watch the video. And we're specifically Hisense and TCL, which TCL come to the UK, which is good news. Another TV manufacturer entering the fray. They will be more at the budget end. But I've got to say, even though they're at the budget end, they've got some nice stuff there, Steve. Harman Kardon audio on their soundbar on the Monolith design TV, which looked really good.
Yeah, no. Yeah, Harman Kardon are on their TVs, a Samsung company these days. They looked quite nice. And it's always good to have another manufacturer, I think, in any marketplace. Competition's good. And we've seen the benefits that Hisense being in the marketplace has brought. So, yeah, I certainly welcome TCL. I think it'd be great.
And speaking of Hisense, if they want to send me a 4K TV for the months of June and July, I'll be more than happy to take one. Because they've got the 4K World Cup app, haven't they?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, that's a cracking little selling point for them, though, isn't it, really? Right, okay, so that's the TV's done with. Hopefully Ed is over his jet lag and is not falling asleep on us, and is here to talk audio.
I am? Well, yeah. I find myself in two minds about where we sit with audio for CES 2018, in so much as we saw some good product break cover. Technics SL1000R, I mean, it's pipe dream stuff. It's only marginally more attainable than micro LED in terms of the realistic likelihood of one turning up in your house, although, you know, it exists and all the rest of it, on a more, you know, sane level, the new Cord Qtus DAC and the like. Where I think perhaps a conversation needs to be had another time is that I'm reasonably confident that we're actually going to see as many products unveiled at Bristol in two channel terms as we sort of saw at the entirety of CES. It sort of rammed home this year that it really isn't that much of a priority for audio and AV manufacturers anymore.
CES is basically been the pipe dream show, sort of like your Munich high end. It's always been the way with the Venetian and so on. And the Venetian used to be a lot larger than it is these days in terms
one
of,
floor this yeah, year basically.
Yeah. It used to be a number of floors in the Venetian, and then you had even more off campus, as they would say, in other hotels and so on. So in terms of you know, the floor space and so on, it has reduced, but it's reduced because people don't go to CES for audio as much these days, and the stuff that you do see is your pipe dream stuff, like your SP10 and your SL1000 turntables and so on at $20,000. It's never been a show for mainstream audio.
This is probably fair, but it's worth pointing out that two other shows in particular have done a very good job of squaring that particular circle. Obviously there's Munich, which, you know, we've been covering from the foreign perspective for a little while now, but specifically for Americans, in late summer, early autumn, there'll be the Rocky Mountain Audio Show, and that, don't get me wrong, it's got some stuff which weighs tons and is, you know, improbably expensive, but that's interspersed again a bit like Munich with items that are more mainstream and affordable. And because there isn't the focus on drones and autonomous crop spraying helicopters and all the other, you know, panoply of CES that I suppose does make CES what it is, manufacturers, we're starting to see this in so many categories, and televisions is no exception. And we were discussing this in our Kia Soul. When you actually want to create a specific industry buzz about what you're doing, you end up choosing to either run your own event or go to a show which is more specific. So we see hi-fi manufacturers leaving for Rocky Mountain and for Munich. We see companies like Microsoft and the like going, well, actually, we're just going to do our own event. And it starts to bleed away the reason why everyone went to CES in the first place. And it becomes a point. I agreed with what you said in the car, mainly because I was desperate to go to the loo, and by agreeing with you, you'd end the video and allow me to go to the loo. I do think it will continue in a vibrant form, but the scope, the nature of what it's catering for will be different. It will go more towards the emerging tech and the companies wanting to get a foothold in whatever market, and we'll see more of the Samsung event sort of thing that you went to, the Panasonic event sort of thing that you went to, and then I'll toddle off to dedicated audio shows, and big chunks of what was historically CES will have sort of fallen by the wayside.
It's one of these strange shows, though, CES, and it's been around for a long time. And the reason it's been around for a long time, much the same as Bristol and all the rest of it, is that it learns to develop as it goes along, and it goes with the trends. And what you tend to find is that you'll have your big companies like Microsoft and so on, who will be there for a few decades, and then it they'll outgrow it and move on, and then you have new money coming in. And one of the things I did say in that video was that, you know, 5 years ago there wasn't any Chinese manufacturers on the main floors. Now you can't move for the number of Chinese manufacturers who have the money and the know-how to put these huge stands on in the main halls, where 5 years ago, you know, that wasn't the thing. You had your Toshibas and your Sharps and everybody, but those companies have moved on. They're no longer viable companies. They're no longer doing what it is that needs to be done. And CES will develop like that. So, yes, it'll always have TVs. It'll always have audio and so on, but it'll change with time, and it'll change with the way that people want to do things. And these bigger companies will go off and do their own things, but are they still getting the same amount of buzz as the start of the year CES show?
Well, this is going to be an interesting one for them to judge and for us to judge. I mean, in terms of moving to a different show, I don't think that's a problem. We've discussed the likelihood is I'm heading out to Munich anyway. It makes no odds. We just do more when I'm out there. In terms of hosting their own events, that's a thing that companies have to judge very, very carefully indeed, because when Apple and Microsoft do it, they're you know, a pretty big deal, and we sort of feel compelled to give them some attention. When you're, and I'm not, it's not even a case of a small company, when you're Samsung or LG, you know, these are companies of some consequence, but would we traipse out to a keynote event on the other side of the Atlantic for them?
No, you wouldn't. And this is the problem for them, and this is why they do their events at CES. They just don't do it on campus. They do it off-site. The journalists are already out there. The people that they want to aim at, they're already out there. They just do their own thing, and they do it a day before the show opens or whatever, and get people along to it. That's the way they'll do it. They do not have any pull. And the other thing is, you know, we've got an event coming up in February, which myself and Steve were supposed to go along to. But when you take into travelling and all the rest of it, myself and Steve would be out of the office for 3 days each. I'd be out of the office for 4 days, Steve 3 days. That's 7 days. And when you're a company and you're looking at how you're funding your resources and looking at what kind of content you can get and so on, which is my job, 7 days out of the office for two of us, that's just undoable. Even if it is a big company and it's the 100th anniversary event, there's no way that the two of us could do that.
Nintendo have managed perfectly well this week by launching something over the internet that's gone down an absolute storm, haven't they, without getting anyone out of the bed.
So I mean, we're just a small company, and if we're looking at things like that, then you've got to, you know, imagine that the big publishers are the same. And is it worth, you know, 3 days of my journalist's time to go and cover something where there's nothing else to cover other than that company, and it won't work? So CES and the big shows like that, like Munich and all the rest of it, they will still happen, and things will happen around the periphery. People will do their own thing, but they'll be around the periphery of the big show where they're taking journalists out for press trips and all that kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of hi-fi, the reports up there, there were some cool things, many of which I'm trying to follow on with in terms of reviews in the next couple of months. Cord Electronics will be assisting, will be getting Acutist over to us as soon as they can. After some of the comments, I will be trying to have a look at the Beyer Dynamic wireless headphone system, not least because of its auto setup, which is very intriguing. So we'll be following up on that, and I've sent I've asked Technics nicely if they're prepared to let me have an SO1000R. They didn't say no, so we'll see how we go from there. In many regards, for hi-fi, the only thing that sort of happened that, you know, as I said in the video, makes me feel momentarily smug. Two-channel audio is being pulled in two different directions. We're still trying to accommodate vinyl with, you know, analog outputs and the requirements it has, and at the same time, you know, work with Alexa, work with Google Assistant, do more wireless material, access more online content. And for the moment, it's not affecting it structurally, being pulled in these two very different directions. So that's great news, but there might be a point where a couple of manufacturers have to decide which way they want to sit and go in. So we'll keep an eye on that over the course of the year.
Right, so that's our thoughts on CES. I'm sure we'll come back to it as the year goes on and as the products start to come to market and we start to get our hands on them. And it was one of those years where things just moved along. And moved along nicely. There wasn't any real innovation there that we need to make a song and dance about. There's some interesting things coming in the future if they arrive, and it's quite a big if on that one. But I guess just another CES, Steve, another evolution, and one that we can quite happily forget about and look forward to next January.
Yeah, I guess so. very much evolutionary rather than revolutionary, and we'll see. Hopefully, I think next year might be a lot more revolutionary, if only because HDMI 2.1 will be finally available.
And probably make a bigger mess than everything else put together, which is normally the case. And if anybody's interested, CES next year is on the... it's the same days, really. You're just one day behind. So it will be the 7th that it starts next year. So there you go. A year in advance for telling you these things. Next is movies. Right, Steve, we haven't heard your voice for at least 10 minutes, so film's coming, or opening, rather, this Friday.
Yeah, we've got Downsizing, which is a high-concept tale where people are physically reduced in size in order to live a cheaper life and take up less space. So obviously it's an allegory, quite clearly. With Matt Damon, that's coming out. We've also got Early Man, which is an urban animation. About a group of cavemen who discover that the rest of the world has evolved and moved on, and they've been left behind. We've got 12 Strong, which is an Afghanistan-based war film post 9/11 thing.
God, that sounds like Hemsworth. A laugh
a minute. Yeah, I think that's going to play better in the States. Also the third part of the Maze Runner series, Maze Runner: The Death Cure. I haven't seen Maze Runner or Maze Runner. Whatever the second one was called.
And if you haven't seen them, what hope is there for anyone else?
Well, doesn't mean to say I don't own them.
Jesus.
That tells you everything you need to know.
Well, it looks like I'm giving Audien $17.99 this month.
This month's not looking great. I do quite fancy seeing it opened up today, the day we're recording, but I quite fancy The Post, which is the new Spielberg film with Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep about the Pentagon Papers, which is an interesting subject and something I'm interested in personally. So I might go and see that. But yeah, the big stuff's coming out. We got some big titles in February, particularly The Black Panther, which I'm looking forward to. But yeah, this week, not a strong lineup. Unless you're a big Aardman fan, I suppose. Aardman are always a laugh. Maybe worth checking out.
Okay, disc releases this week.
This week is actually a couple of good ones. Wind River, which I have seen and is an excellent sort of mystery thriller, written by the guy, this is also directed by him, but he wrote Sicario and Hell or High Water.
Yeah, I wanted to go and see this one at the cinema, but it was stupidly late showing times for some strange reason, and I always kept calling it Wild River for some reason, but that was actually another film altogether with...
Yeah, that was one Meryl Streep, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was
Wild or something like that. Wind River, it's set on the Indian Reservation as a murder and an investigation, and an FBI agent gets sent in, played by Elizabeth Olsen. The main lead is Jeremy Renner, and he's excellent. They're actually all excellent. It's some great performances in this film. It's got some really cracking top draw violence, nice realistic violence. It's got an interesting story. It does address the issues of Native Americans and their lives and how grim they are on some of these reservations. And I thought it beautifully photographed as well. In the mountainside scenery is stunning. And really good movie. So I thoroughly recommend Wind River. If you haven't seen it, check it out. Also got The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes, which is a late period Billy Wilder movie, 1970. Actually quite a good fun movie. This is a major influence, Mark Gatiss admits this, on the BBC series Sherlock. And it is an interesting film with a great performance by Robert Stevens as a slightly camp Sherlock, but is an interesting take on the character. Also got an interesting take on the character of Watson as well. It's funny, but it's also it's not irreverent in the sense it does pay homage to the original books. It's quite clever. It didn't do well when it came out. It was originally shot as a 3-hour kind of roadshow film, and they had to cut an hour out. There's a whole thing on the disc about the hour that's missing, which is a shame they can't find the original footage and reinstate it. But it makes for an interesting film anyway, and it's full of the Billy Wilder's wit and sharp observations, and it's certainly, if you're a Sherlock fan, then it's worth checking out. Also coming out on both Ultra HD Blu-ray and Blu-ray is Mother, Darren Aronofsky's film, which I saw at the cinema and then I never want to see again as long as I live. It's challenging, that's all I'm going to say.
You've got the 4K disc?
No, I didn't buy it. Even though it's got Dolby Atmos and Dolby Vision, I resisted because I do not want to sit through this film a second time. It is very challenging. But if it's something you think you might find interesting, it's available on Blu-ray and Ultra HD Blu-ray. And announced for Ultra HD Blu-ray over the next couple of months, we've got in February, we've got Thor Ragnarok. And then in March, there's Justice League. And at the end of March, Star Wars The Last Jedi.
What? Never heard of it.
That's available for those of you who maybe didn't go and see it in the cinema, quite wisely.
Okay, and Peter Wingard.
Yes, Peter Wingard, who's most well known for playing Jason King in the late 60s, early 70s, sporting some of the most impressive facial hair ever seen on television, I think. And also, perhaps more famous for not being able to see his face at all, playing Clitus in Flash Gordon, the 1980 Flash Gordon by, produced by... Dino De Laurentiis, so for my generation, he'll always be Clitus. His voice is very distinctive, so you know it's him because you find his voice, but you don't actually see his face. But probably for a generation before, he's more famous for being Peter King, Jason King, this detective, very late 60s, early 70s look to it, which in itself is worth checking out. But I think he's been getting a lot of attention on the forums, I noticed, so obviously not just me that remembers him. Sadly, he passed away this week.
He's a distinctive looking bloke, and not simply because he had a very unique take on sartorial elegance. He certainly rocked some interesting costumes over the years. I didn't see any of the Jason King stuff. I mean, obviously, Flash. I'm disappointed to learn it wasn't his eyes that pop out of the mask when he gets impaled. Sorry, spoilers there. But equally he was what, 90, wasn't he? That's not a bad run. And he appears to live on as countless 70s man internet memes, so good for him. He's attained an immortality all of his own.
He survived 4 years in a Japanese concentration camp.
He did. He was alongside J.G. Ballard,
yeah, bizarrely.
Rest in peace, chap. I hope that there's lots of velour and very wide lapels wherever you've wound up.
And on that, it's time to end. It's been a bit of a marathon to get through this week, but that is CES over and done with for another year. we're glad to see the back of it. It's it's almost like a month of our lives. Think about things.
Yeah, it feels like it.
It does, doesn't it? It's yeah. So, well, thankfully, we don't need to do it again for at least another 12 months. And hopefully in that time, we'll see what products make it to market and which ones don't. So that's it for this week. My thanks to Steve Withers.
Should we stop the torture?
We're only just starting. Mark Hodgkinson.
That was mine as well. Pathetic earthlings.
Ed Selly.
This Ming is a psycho.
Don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook, bookmark AV Forums for latest reviews, news and videos, and of course, leave us a 5-star rating on iTunes, but only if you enjoyed the show. I'm Phil Hinton. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you again next week.